Sorry, froze for a second. All right. I'm sorry. Our next presentation is by Michael Wyatt. Chemical alteration of the salt in the Amazonian Omega Tests and GRS integrated data sets.
Got 15.
And then the down button?
3. Yeah. Any button.
Okay. All right. Well, I'd like to first say thank you for giving me the opportunity to come here and present this work, and certainly I'm happy to be able to share some short stories about Phil. I'll give you a little bit of background. I came to meet Phil originally as a graduate student at the University of Tennessee, where I was working with a co-investigator of TESS, Hap McSween, for my PhD. And Phil and his group were always extremely helpful in teaching people from outside their group how to work with the test data set. And a couple just quick stories. I think it was in my fourth year of my PhD. I was out at Arizona State using their lab spectrometer, and I was beginning to think about postdocs, okay, like what am I going to do with the rest of my life, or at least for the next few years. And I was talking with Phil, and sort of halfway through a conversation, he asked, so what are you going to do when you graduate? And I said, well, I think I'd like to do a postdoc somewhere. And he said, well, would you like to do a postdoc here? I said, sure. And then like we quickly went on to another topic of conversation. I remember leaving Arizona State and calling my mom and dad and saying, God, I think I just got a job offer. And then, you know, I showed up one day and it all kind of worked. And then just to give you an idea, I was very, very enthusiastic about going to Arizona State because, you know, that was the place to be doing certainly compositional remote sensing. And I wanted to leave, I think, like the day after I finished my graduation, and Phil said, no, take your time, you know, there's no rush, take your time to get out here. And by the time I finally did make it out to Arizona State, I remember one morning, I was in bed, and I started to wake up, and I heard Phil's voice, and I'm thinking, why am I hearing Phil's voice in bed? And then this was about the time that Themis went into orbit, and they started getting back some of the initial data sets, and Phil was being interviewed on NPR. Which was where my alarm clock was set to. And I remember just kind of showering and thinking, okay, keep your cool, get into work, nothing weird. And then, but I had a wonderful several years working with Phil and his group, and I'm very happy to be here. So to get started, what I'm going to be talking about is putting TESS in the context of a lot of the other data sets that have been returned from Mars relating to compositions. And this will be a very TESS-focused talk, and talk about how TESS actually provides unique insights into the composition of the Martian surface. As we heard in the previous talk, TESS is dominating, the signatures are dominating of primary igneous minerals. And so these are just some of the older maps that Vicky showed showing plagioclase and high calcium pyroxene. And as Vicky went on to show, you know, there are some very broad scale similarities between where you see pyroxenes from TESS and where you see pyroxenes from Omega. Obviously there's a lot of fine detail that we're not talking about here, but the reason just to kind of put this up in the beginning is that the materials that we're going to be talking about as far as a classification really are going to be basaltic materials. This is a map of total silica content from GRS recast as oxides, and when you plot silica contents from GRS, what we're dealing with are basaltic compositions in kind of your typical kind of terrestrial basalts, and that's really the initial starting composition that I'm going to be focusing on in this talk, and then talking about alteration from basalt. The point that I obviously of this presentation is the chemical alteration of basalt and how all of these different data sets can be used together, and how TESS really provides some unique insight. Okay, so to kind of give you the end of the story in the beginning, what this talk is really going to focus about is the sampling depth of these different instruments and how the different sampling depths do provide unique information about the surface composition. This is not drawn at all to scale, but the GRS data that I'll be talking about really are sampling down to tens of centimeters, okay, providing an average over that depth. TESS and Omega are really only giving us information about the upper hundreds to tens of microns, and what's interesting is that some of the disparities that you see between these data sets aren't really problems, but in fact actually I think revealing some new compositional insights into what the Martian surface is made of. So the data that I'm going to be talking about in this presentation under GRS, I'm going to be talking about potassium over thorium ratios to kind of set the stage and talk about what we're starting with. And then I'm going to be talking about the different major groups of test data that have been talked about extensively, and then how basically all of these data sets fit into the story of Omega and the kind of alteration hypotheses that have been put forward with Omega. I think TESS reveals actually some new insights into how this type of a figure can be modified. Okay, so to get started, this is a lot of work kind of summarizing from a lot of different papers, but this is a GRS map of potassium over thorium, and the reason to show this is that potassium and thorium will typically fractionate from one another under aqueous processes. A lot of work by Taylor et al. And Karen Tulaki showed that under a wide range of aqueous processes on Earth, under a wide range of pHs, typically potassium will fractionate from thorium, and so if you saw wide spread evidence of aqueous alteration, you would expect this map to possibly reveal that. Now, what Taylor et al. And Boynton et al. Have shown is that most of the potassium-thorium ratios on Mars are within this very narrow range compared to, say, terrestrial values. And what that's been used to show is that there really is no significant variation in potassium and thorium, and that most of this entire differences that you see in this map could be explained by magmatic processes. Okay, so when I'm talking about alteration today, I'm not talking about widespread extensive alteration. It's going to be fairly limited degrees, and that's really controlled by GRS data. One point to just make also is that it's the potassium-thorium ratio, while indicative of aqueous alteration processes, the absolute abundances of potassium and thorium do vary quite a lot on Mars and actually trend together, in that the northern plains, which is an area that we'll be focusing on, show very high abundances of both potassium and thorium. And what this has been used to suggest from the GRS point of view is that these absolute abundances are reflecting a distinct magma source region. Okay, so from a starting point, what we're dealing with is basalt, probably from a unique starting composition deep within the mantle, and is reflecting itself with the potassium-thorium absolute abundances. All right, well, so to get started then on test data and how this all kind of fits in, here we're just showing a global map of test compositions and the kind of early type 1, type 2 type of distributions that were discussed by Banfield et al. And as will be talked about in a lot of other presentations today, you know, there were multiple different ideas that came out of this test data to explain what these types of phases might be. And a lot of this came from a lot of laboratory work showing that both andesites and different types of alteration products could be modeled into this data and be explaining the kind of variations we see. What we'll see in a little bit is that actually by using GRS and Omega data and test data all together, we can begin to cross some of these out. And so at least based on GRS data, again, what we see at least with the bulk silica content, which is how you classify volcanic rocks typically from a petrologic standpoint, you know, it really seems to rule out wide expanses of andesite, at least on this global GRS scale. There is absolutely evolved volcanic compositions that have been mapped with Themis and test data across different parts of Mars, but at least on this kind of global scale, you don't seem to, at least with GRS, have really high silica contents. All right, so but what that leaves us with then is this sort of wide range of different alteration products that could be used to explain what some of this material in the northern lowlands and parts of the southern highlands may actually be made of. And for that, we'll go to Omega data and see how Omega can actually put some constraints on this. But first, I'm a slide ahead, sorry. What these alteration stories do kind of show is that some of these early papers that were suggesting latitude-dependent layers where you have ice and perhaps even water at high latitudes to explain the overall distribution of these type 1, type 2 could be explaining this kind of distribution. And this is some work that we did in 2004 to show that you can correlate the distributions of type 2 with where you find these latitude-dependent mantles. And in some really nice, more recent work, Deanne Rogers and Phil showed that this group 1, and this is some of the work that Vicky was talking about, which has the highest abundances of these silica phases, really do kind of fall into these latitude-dependent layers. And so that's a little bit about what we're kind of focusing in on. But there's still this question of what these materials are actually, what part of that material is going to be made of. And for that, we'll go to Omega. And what we see in Omega data when we look at the northern lowlands up here, showing two different spectra. The one is Syrtis Major, just to kind of give you a representative idea of how pyroxenes are very obvious there. In the northern lowlands, you see this very flat blue slope spectrum, which is kind of featureless when it comes to what minerals are going to be identified there. And so what Omega basically is telling us is that anything that you might expect in basalt and andesite is not really present there. But also, you don't have any phyllosilicates or hydrated minerals, which were some of those identified by TESS, but alteration rinds or coatings could be present. And so what we're going to be doing now is by looking at Omega and TESS data together, what we can really kind of cross out are some of these hydrated, if they're well crystalline hydrated phases, you certainly would expect to see these in Omega data, and you don't. Okay. And so by using the data sets together, we're able to kind of refine these possibilities. So what then we are able to do is, based on the kind of remaining phases, one of those was palagonite, and one of the things that you can also do with test data is actually not just measure the mineral abundances, but go all the way to chemistry. And this was a lot of work that people like Vicky and myself and others did as part of our PhD, showing that you can actually model chemistry with test data. And this is just an example of how you go from a basalt spectrum to kind of a modal mineralogy, and then you can actually get mineral chemistry and even get rock chemistry, all from thermal emission data. So one of the plots to show here is kind of a typical diagram that you see with terrestrial studies of alteration, is plotting magnesium over silica versus aluminum over silica, and you have these two distinct fractionation lines that separate the terrestrial compositions and the Martian crust, and then moving in this direction off of the Earth's crust line is really where you get alteration and palagonitization moving compositions. And when you go through the process of correcting test data all the way to chemistry, you can see that a lot of the test data plots in this direction, which is probably indicating that some of those poorly crystalline aluminum silicon-like phases, which aren't really phyllosilicates but just very immature sediments, could be explaining some of the spectral signatures in all of the data. All right, so then what does this all kind of mean as far as bringing it together? Well, we started out by talking that GRS is sampling deeper than both Omega and TESS, and what that really is showing is that GRS in this acidalia region is indicating that you have probably these initial bulk differentiation processes producing compositionally distinct basaltic compositions. Okay, that's from the potassium and thorium abundance. The ratios don't appear to show that there's a significant amount of alteration. Now, when you look at the GRS silica abundance, you know, you really are seeing that everything is pretty much classified as basalt, which is very consistent with the kind of alteration that you might expect with test data at thinner layers being very affecting the test data, but not really anything with GRS. And that what that kind of points to is that you can have thin coatings on basalts, which is consistent with both TESS and GRS, and that this is really a TESS insight. GRS is essentially invisible to this, but the thinner sampling of test data is really indicating that you do probably have these near-surface alteration processes. Okay, so then what does this mean then, just to finish up, when it comes back to this kind of a model? For those of you, I'm sure many of you are familiar with how, based on Omega data, there's been ideas put forward that you have both a change in pH to explain going from clays in the Noachian to sulfates and then anhydrous ferric oxides. But one of the other obviously big points in this type of a diagram is that it's also showing that you have decreasing amounts of water affecting the surface. Now, while that's true, some of the evidence from Omega is really not picking out what test data is seeing, and that's because obviously the Omega data is much more sensitive to the iron-bearing mineralogy, whereas TESS is very sensitive to the silica-bearing mineralogy. And so you have to take into consideration these amorphous high silica coatings or palagonites that a lot of people have talked about, as far as if you're going to talk about alteration on a global scale, TESS really does make a significant contribution here. And what that really does point to is that some really nice work by McLennan showed that you do need water to form these kind of silica alteration coatings. You can't just have it be solid ice. You need to have some amount of water. And so based on this kind of Omega map, this anhydrous ferric oxides, this is kind of how I like to finish up as a, not hopefully joking, but that you could rename some of these most recent Amazonian-aged materials perhaps as the silician if you're going to do it from a test data standpoint. And the reason for that is that if you're looking at alteration, TESS really is providing probably a unique picture into the most recent alteration, and it is dominated by high silica alteration products. And so TESS has made, I think, a fundamentally important contribution to this global type of picture, and by using all three data sets, you can really constrain the mineralogy that's observed. So with that, I'd like to finish up. Thank you.
We have time for a question or a comment.
Sold. Okay.
Thank you. Thanks very much. We'll move on to the next paper, if I can get to it.